Welcome to the tween and teen years. What's normal, what's not? My name is Sara Dimmerman, also known as Help Me Sara, and I'm joined today by Dr. Karen Leitner. Over the next little while, we're going to chat about what's normal and what's not during the tween and teen years. Welcome, Karen.
Hi.
Karen, perhaps we could begin by you just telling us a little bit about yourself and the work that you do.
Okay. I'm in private practice. I work in Aurora. I'm in a center called the Child and Adolescent Psychology Center. And I work with children with anxiety, depression. I work with specifically obsessive compulsive disorder, children who have experienced trauma, sexual abuse, grieving children, gender identity disorder. So I really see a wide range of children with different issues. And the age range I see is from age 4 to 22.
So really, some of those children are not even very little children. They're young adults by the time they see you.
Yes, yes. I tend to see more of the adolescents.
Okay. And you and I were just chatting about how the, you know, even though the topic is tweens and teens, how so many tweens nowadays are really like the teens of yesteryear. And it made me think of my 12-year-old, who's definitely more of a teen than she is a tween even, and how recently I bought her one of the Chicken Soup for the Soul books for the preteen, thinking that she would relate very well to those stories. But unfortunately, she's told me that she would prefer the teen book because she can relate to some of those. It's scary for me as a parent and as a professional, because I know that some of those stories might deal with things that she may actually not be involved in yet. But I know that what she knows now is certainly far more than what I ever knew. And that's a good thing as well as not, because as you're probably aware, and I don't know if you'd agree, children are unfortunately skipping some of their innocence, you know, and moving on to more becoming more little adults and knowing, being so streetwise. And taking on so much of the world, really.
I would definitely agree. I think children are growing up faster. They're being exposed through the media to things that that they weren't 10, 20, 30 years ago.
Absolutely. So I guess that kind of brings us to the topic of what's normal and what's not, because I guess, you know, what's normal now is possibly not what was normal 10 or 20 years ago, based on the way that the world has changed, the way that we parent, maybe even in terms of being more democratic in our style, or including our children in more decision making, or even not being as cautious, maybe even about what we share in front of our children or what we expose them to. And as you mentioned, even with the media, it's very difficult to restrict your children from watching any TV, and they're going to hear and see things that they might not have heard a long time ago. And I guess, too, growing up in different cultures, too, right? Because I grew up in South Africa, which was very conservative. Children were really more shrouded. And I think in North America, children are exposed to more just culturally. So would you like to just chat a little bit about what you would perceive as what's so-called? I know normal, when we talk about normal, we're talking about average, correct? Like what we
Yes.
typically see.
So you're, in terms of the adolescent, it's a time of turmoil. There are hormonal changes. It's a developmental stage that is quite different from the earlier stage, latency, which is when children are, in their middle years.
Right.
As they get into adolescence, as I just said, there are hormonal changes, which bring on a lot of emotional turmoil.
Right.
So you're going to see children being more irritable, with mood swings, more argumentative, more oppositional.
Right.
There's a real push and pull with parents.
Right.
That children are, they're trying to become more independent as adolescents, but yet you'll also see regressive behavior where they seem very young at times, and parents are scratching their heads thinking, you know, my child is capable of doing that, and yet they're saying that that they can't do it, that I need to do it for them. And then on the other hand, they're making requests of me to let them be more independent right. when I don't feel that.
Right. Like they're saying, I'm old enough to make decisions about who I spend my time with. But then the next minute they're saying, I can't get a bus home on my own. Can you please pick me up?
Exactly.
So that, and I see that too, that conflict, internal conflict in terms of wanting to be all grown up and yet maybe not having the life skills, or maybe just secretly inside wanting to crawl into your bed at night and snuggle. Or, yes. And actually not even so secretly. I know that there are adolescents who do. So what you're saying, I think, and what I would agree with is that it's not a flat continuum, right? It's not like they grow up at the same rate all the time, but they can flip-flop between being very mature and wanting more independence and then being quite juvenile and wanting to snuggle with you in bed.
Exactly. And for parents, that's very confusing.
Right. And so when you talk about, you know, changes in hormones, which I can, you know, which I would agree with, and you talk about changes in mood, maybe increased irritability or moodiness. I mean, how does a parent decide that this is just a phase versus I need some professional help?
That's a very good question. And I think you look for professional help when you become concerned that your child is depressed, for instance, or overly anxious, when their mood is really interfering with their academic progress, with their social skills.
Right.
Those are times when you would begin to worry. For instance, if your child has withdrawn from you, now that can be very typical right. in adolescence. However, if they've withdrawn from their peers, that to me would be a red flag. When their mood seems low, their motivation is low, they don't have a lot of energy, they're not eating properly.
Sorry to interrupt, but would it also depend partly also on the length of time? Like at what point would you say this phase or the stage has gone on beyond what it should? Is it quantitative in terms of measuring time in any way?
It can. I mean, you know, sometimes children, adolescents, I should say, you'll see some sudden changes, and you really want, as a parent, you need to be very alert and observant. And if your gut feeling is telling you something isn't right,
yeah.
the first thing you need to do, of course, is approach your child. You need to be keeping those lines of communication open.
Right.
And if your child's mood is very low, you want to be observing that and aware of it and not let it go on for too long.
Right. So I guess also it's about seeing sudden changes, like out of character changes.
Mm-hmm.
Like if your child is typically a pretty happy-go-lucky kid and then suddenly is not wanting to get up in the morning and seems very low, then that's something that you shouldn't just excuse as a phase. But, you know, even if it's for a short time, but just maybe get some professional help or guidance.
Yes. And I think that the parent can take the first steps by really trying to open the lines of communication with their child.
So what kinds of things might you say to your child in terms of trying to get an understanding of whether what they're going through is something related to maybe things that are happening at school versus, you know, versus maybe some kind of hormonal imbalance?
Well, being engaged with your child and being a good listener, you can often get a lot of information. I often say to parents, get in the car and drive with your child
yeah.
and ask them not to have their earbuds in and just have a conversation with them. They can't jump out of the car.
Right.
They're stuck. And often that is a really good opportunity just to get a sense of what's going on. And for some, peers are everything, friends are everything
right.
to the adolescent. And maybe something has happened and the child has been ostracized, been rejected from their peer group. Mm-hmm. And that can actually lead to some very low mood
yeah.
because for adolescents, fitting in is everything.
Absolutely. I love the idea of getting in the car. And I think, you know, obviously a parent wouldn't want to probably make that an obvious, let's get in the car and talk, right?
No, no.
But it's about being receptive to maybe driving your children longer distances to friends' homes and then taking advantage of that enclosed space to be able to talk. One of the other things that I've heard is really effective is texting or emailing, because although I think, you know, we as adults or parents sometimes have a difficult time with our children relating to each other that way. I find that as a parent, even sometimes if my child doesn't want to open up to me face to face, then texting or emailing or BBMing is a good way of getting to the heart of the matter a little better. Have you noticed that too?
Definitely, definitely. Use the tools that your child uses to communicate.
Right.
And you will get more from them. And I really can't emphasize enough how important it is to listen. Be a good listener. I think as parents, we flip into that lecture mode very quickly. Mm-hmm. We're the ones that have all the knowledge and are giving them advice. And that's not helpful, because kids are very good at just tuning you out.
Mm-hmm. And by listening, you know, I often talk to families about listening too. And maybe we should just clarify what listening is, because when you're talking listening, I presume you're talking active listening, right?
Yes.
So I guess it's about hearing what your child has to say. And instead of feeling that you need to give advice or lecturing, that it's better to just validate what they're saying or acknowledge what they're saying, give them just feedback to them what you've heard as a way of your child and feeling like you have heard him or her. And it's actually quite an amazing exercise, I find, when parents do that, because they're quite astounded by how much further they can go with a conversation and so much less work. They don't have to do anything. They just have to actively listen.
That's right. That's right.
And just speaking about something that I spoke about earlier, about the snuggling in bed, you know, I don't think that children are ever too young to snuggle with their parents in bed occasionally. And I've always found, no matter the age of the child, but especially as tweens, that the best time of day is to get into your bed and get into your child's bed and talk with the lights out. I find that when children don't have to look at you directly, they're more inclined to share information in the dark.
Definitely. And I find that evening is a time when kids are winding down and maybe they're a little bit more vulnerable, and they will open up to you.
And also
at that time.
And they're looking for ways to stay up longer, right? for the younger kids, for the ones
right.
That you're still going to bed, you know, after the teenagers, the older kids, we're often going to bed later than them even, right?
Oh, yes.
In fact, let's talk about that for a second. I mean, have you noticed that children's sleep habits have changed, or that older, you know, teenagers, or like, what have you noticed in terms of sleep patterns and behavior with that?
Well, I think many teens are not getting enough sleep. And when a parent really needs to worry is when the teen starts flipping their sleep-wake cycle and are up in the middle of the night and then can't wake up in the morning, start missing school. That's really problematic. But just getting back to a normal teen, they do tend to go to bed later and have a lot of difficulty waking up. And many schools start very early, where children have to be in the class by 8 o'clock, 8:15, which is very difficult for tweens and particularly for teens.
Right.
And I think what happens is they, with all the technology that's available, they have difficulty setting the limits. And that's where parents have to set limits around texting at all hours of the night. I've had that experience with my daughter where, you know, she's texting at 1 a.m.
Right.
And it's that they don't want to miss out on anything.
Well, it's a 24-hour cycle, 24/7 cycle, right? There's no shutting down at all in the world of technology. So you're right. I mean, 1 o'clock, 2, I've, you know, heard of kids at 3 o'clock still Facebooking and texting.
And I think that's where parents need to set some rules.
So how would you recommend that I think that's a very common concern. You know, what would a parent, or how would a parent approach their teenager around that in terms of setting rules?
Well, I think that you do need to take a hard line and say that the phone and the child's phone, iPhone, BlackBerry, whatever it might be, and their laptop need to come out of their bedroom. That the bedroom is not the place for their phone and their laptop or their tablet, whatever it might be.
Right.
That needs to be in the kitchen or somewhere where it's not tempting them.
Are you saying at all times of the day and night, or
no,
just after a certain hour?
I would say at bedtime.
Yeah.
At bedtime, you know, when they go through their bedtime ritual, part of that ritual is turn off the technology, and it should be out of their room because it's just too tempting.
Yeah. So, I mean, but if you're dealing with, say, an 18 or 19-year-old, it's very difficult, isn't it?
It is. At that point in time, I think you can stick to your rule. The child may ignore your rules, but you are giving them a strong message. Even at 18, if you're seeing that the child is exhausted, that it's affecting their grades, mm-hmm. you can say to them, you know, you can confront them,
right,
and say, this is not okay. I don't agree with this.
And I'm thinking even, you know, I'm a big believer in democratic parenting, which would mean including your children and your concerns and coming up with solutions together. And so I'm thinking that by that age, you know, it would be nice if you could view your young adult child as, you know, a very crucial part of your family, and in terms of decision-making too. So I find that using word like rule sometimes isn't as effective. I don't know what you found, but even changing that a little bit to guidelines or something like that and saying, you know, I have a concern because of this, and maybe can we work something out so that I'm not as concerned and that you're getting better sleep, and try to find a resolution together. Mm-hmm. Do you find that works any better than...
I think it can. You know, that's some very good problem solving. I do feel that parents need to take a firm line and be consistent.
Right.
I think the democratic parenting is very important. But if you can't come to a resolution with
right.
your child, and I find in the early teen years in particular, they have a need to push.
Yeah.
The limits.
Right.
And not to agree with the parent often.
Right.
And that's normal.
Right.
And in those years, you know, even like 11 to 14, 15 years old, when a child is pushing for something that you know is not a good thing for them to be doing, whether
right.
it's a party without any supervision,
right.
and they're pushing and pushing and trying to get you to agree,
right.
I think that's a time where you need to be firm and consistent.
And I agree. I think, you know, often parents don't sit together enough if you're co-parenting to even figure out what their parenting style is or what they believe in together so that they can present a united front. And I know, you know, I think that especially when your child is younger, like the earlier teen, like the 11, 12-year-old, 13, I find it's a very slippery slope if you don't set. I know with my 12-year-old, her biggest passion now is going to a mall and hanging out with her friends, you know? And I'm really reticent to allow that right now because I think that, you know, I've always been a believer that just hanging out in a mall is not the best place to hang out. And so when she says, I'm old enough to hang out with my friend, I know where the stores are and stuff like that, I'm just not convinced that she has the life skills to handle difficult or dangerous situations that might arise. What happens if there's a red alert at the mall and the mall gets shut down and they can't leave? You know, she might say, well, I can call you on my phone, but what about the trauma of a 12-year-old being exposed to that? I think that as parents, we sometimes just think about, oh, well, our child will just hang in the mall, but we don't sometimes think about what situations they might come up against and whether they're ready to handle them. So I think I always encourage parents to err on the side of just delaying that a little bit, both in terms of just allowing your child to develop better life skills and also delaying gratification, because I think kids are so used to getting what they want right when they want it, as opposed to looking forward to things. So by the time they're 15, they're getting into alcohol and drugs and sex because they've been hanging out in malls for years and they've gotten all the latest brands and they just don't have anything else to excite them. Do you see that too?
I do. And I mean, I think it's really crucial for parents, as you were saying just now, that they really, you need to know who your child's friends are. You need to know where your child is. If you don't feel comfortable with them doing a certain activity, if you don't feel you have all the information, you can say no.
Right. And I will say things like, it's my right and responsibility as your parent to know who you're with and how you're getting home, and, you know, even when they're a little bit older. So I think we do need to, I agree that we do need to take a harder, a stronger stance and not be pushed around as much in terms of giving up because all the other parents may be doing it, or we're being told that all the other parents are doing it.
And kids are very good at pushing and pushing. And I've had parents say to me, my child wears me down, and then I give in.
Yeah.
And really, it's okay for your child to not be happy with your decision.
Absolutely. You don't have to be your child's best friend. What, I mean, it's just talking about alcohol, drugs, and promiscuity, have you noticed, as I have over the last 20 years, that there does seem to be an increase, or that children are getting into that, or tweens and teens are getting into that younger and younger?
They are. And unfortunately, it is quite common. You will find kids experimenting with alcohol at a young age and with drugs. And I think as a parent, again, it's just really, you can't, you know, have your child on a leash, but you have to instill the right values in your child and be aware of their whereabouts to the best of your ability.
Right.
To try to curb that as much as possible. But if you do find that your child has been drinking, I mean, it is a common thing. And it's, if that does happen and your child comes back from someone's house, from a friend's house, and they're drunk, it's having the conversation with them.
Instead of punishing them, rather to talk to them about your concerns and what's going on.
Exactly.
You know, it's interesting. I was recently talking to a parent who was concerned about the peers, or one child in particular that her daughter was hanging out with. And, you know, what I, and you talked about how peers are such an important influence, and I would agree with that. And one of the things that I advised her was that instead of forbidding her child from seeing that the child, because I thought that would actually encourage their relationship.
It would, yes.
To rather just talk to her child, to ask her child questions about the child she was concerned about. So, you know, what do you know about such and such? And what do you think about that? And find questions that will allow your child to arrive at the same conclusion that you have, so that your child ultimately decides this person may not be the best influence on her, rather than you saying that child is a bad influence, don't spend any time with her. So I don't know if you would agree with that.
I do. I definitely agree with that. And I think that process is a very respectful one, because you're not lecturing your child. You're not giving your child advice, because in adolescence, kids, part of the adolescence is pushing against parents, rebelling to a certain extent. And that process that you've just described is very respectful, and really getting the child to do the thinking for themselves and not being able to easily take a stand. Well, if my mother doesn't want me seeing my friend Susie, I'm going to see my friend Susie.
Right. And actually, when you think about it, you know, we talk about the fact that we don't want our children to be manipulated or influenced unduly. But then we do that ourselves, right? We try to find ways to manipulate or influence. And of course, our influence is hopefully a good one. But we want to encourage our children, I'm sure you'd agree, to be independent thinkers, to make wise decisions, to not always, as you said, we don't have them on a leash, and we're not always with them. So I think the most important gift that we could give our tween or teen is figuring out ways to handle difficult situations on their own. Right.
Yes, so, the problem solving is so important.
Right. So when our children are pushing back, or when they're making decisions that we're, you know, that are, when they're making autonomous decisions, or wanting to do things that we don't really want them to do. In fact, when we think about our long-term goals and the way that we want our children to be as adults, we may actually sit back and go, you know what, this is a good thing. I need to maybe listen to what my child is saying. Maybe he or she has some really valid, good ideas. Maybe they're not expressing it to me in the way that I would like. Because, I mean, talking about expressing attitude is something I hear about all the time, right? I mean, every parent's definition of attitude is different. But, you know, my child is disrespectful. He gives me so much attitude. Do you hear that too?
I do. And it's normal.
Yeah.
It's a really normal part of adolescence. They are, the adolescent is, and the tween and the teen are trying to find their voice. And, they are going to, be argumentative.
Right.
And they are going to push parents to, so that they can get what they want.
And we can model that, right? We can model the way that we want them to communicate with us in the way that we communicate with them. So even though we might think that they're being argumentative or defiant or showing us attitude, if we were to record our conversations with them, we might find that we're doing just the same, correct?
Definitely. And one thing that's very hard for parents, I think for anyone, is to walk away from an argument. I think we all kind of feel like we have to get in the last word. And arguments escalate. And if you really examine what you were arguing about, you know, you kind of scratch your head. I spent all that time and energy and got myself so upset arguing with my child about, you know, the fact that it's winter and they're going out without boots.
Right.
You know, there comes a point, you know, you have to pick your fights for one thing. And also you have to be able to walk away.
Mm-hmm. And by walking away, you don't mean like walking away, silent treatment, walking away.
No.
Or throwing up your hands and saying, I give up on you. You're saying just choosing to pick your battles wisely and saying, or maybe even just saying, I need some time to think about this some more. We'll get back and talk about this later.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Rather than escalating.
Right.
An argument.
And the other thing that I recommend to parents, you know, on the subject of curfews or breaking rules, is I'll often say, you know, the worst possible time to confront your child over something that you're unhappy about is at that moment when he walks in at 2 o'clock when he was supposed to be in at midnight, right?
Definitely, yes.
So rather to wait till the next morning to have a more logical and emotional conversation when you've had some time to sleep on it.
But I agree with that. And I would add to that, you must do it. You must have that conversation the next morning. You should not let it go.
Right.
You need to let the child know that what they did was not okay. But in a way, again, letting them also have that, you know, conversation with you so that maybe they will come up with the same decision as you have. The
consequences?
Yes.
Well, because in fact, you know, I often say to parents too that they need to set up consequences in advance, or at least when something goes wrong like that. So I would often recommend, you know, when you're having that logical conversation the next morning, to say, what do you think should happen the next time? Well, let's hope it doesn't happen again, but let's just say it does. What do you think a good consequence for that might be? And I find that children, adolescents, tweens will often come up with more punishments than consequences. So they might say things like, well, I'll lose my TV privileges for a week. And that to me is more of a punishment than a consequence. It's not really related to the problem. But if they come up with something like, well, I'll have to come home at an earlier time next time, or I won't be allowed to go out with my friends for the remainder of that week, that to me would be appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
Would you agree with that?
So really the consequence has to be related to what has...
To the problem itself.
To the problem, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So any ideas about how to keep your adolescent connected to family? I mean, you know, we talked about communication and that kind of thing. What else might you say about that?
I think involving your child in family activities. Now, a teenager isn't going to want to go visiting family or go out with family all of the time. And I think parents have to understand that. But having at least... two or three or more dinners that everyone in the family is expected to sit down at a certain time. I know families get very busy with all sorts of extracurricular activities, but choose at least two or three nights a week where you all sit down together for dinner.
Yeah. And again, I would imagine not to make that like a rule per se, but to model that, like everybody, you know, it's an expectation rather than a rule.
Yes. Yes.
And to make it a positive experience, right? So that you're not sitting down at dinner and lecturing your child about something going on, but you're talking about good things, you're planning family vacations, you're sharing your day and reinforcing positives.
You're listening actively to your child.
Yeah. And studies have shown that families that do eat together, children are less likely to get involved be less influenced by their peers or get involved in drugs, for example. I think that eating together as much as possible is a really valuable experience. And, you know, I know that even with my children, even my 20-year-old enjoys coming on family trips with us. And I think that's not to say that I do everything right by a long stretch, but I think that's because we have a positive experience when we do go away as a family. So she's more inclined to come back the next time. And part of that is about, again, you know, not like making the holidays often more child-centered than adult-centered. So we may not go on that long hike, or we might not go to the museum that we want to go to. We're going to look for activities that our children are going to enjoy.
Yes. And those activities can be close to home as well.
Right.
So that reminds me that, you know, spend time with your child, but not, it shouldn't be your agenda.
Right.
It should be your child's agenda. If your child wants to go shopping, make it a fun activity, go shopping. If your child wants to play golf, and you're able to arrange something like that, go and play golf with them, or go for a long bike ride with them if that's something that they would like to do. So that's a good way of just staying in contact with your child, and you learn a lot about who their friends are, what the issues are for them at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a good way to stay in contact.
And I would imagine that, you know, self-esteem in a teen is often promoted just by having that healthy family relationship. Any other ideas about promoting healthy self-esteem in children or adolescents?
Well, we were talking about respect before, and I think being respectful of your child, active listening to your child, helps to build self-esteem, supporting and encouraging your child. Adolescence is a difficult time, and peer relationships are fraught with difficulty for girls in particular. You see cliques that form and kids being rejected from the clique, and that's so traumatic for a child, and that really affects their self-esteem. That's where they need a parent to be really supportive,
mm-hmm.
and not to be discouraging the child or suggesting that maybe the child's done something wrong. I mean,
right.
I think you can question them and help them to see how they might approach a situation with peers. But they need you to be really supportive. And that really helps them feel good about themselves.
Yeah. And I've noticed, too, that the way that we talk to ourselves or about ourselves also is a strong influence on our teens, too. Like if we're standing in front of the mirror, you know, evaluating our weight and saying, oh, I've gained so much weight, I don't like the way I look, you're gonna maybe have a teenage daughter who's doing the same about herself.
We parents don't realize how much they do influence their kids.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we feel like we don't have any control over our kids, but we do, and we are instilling values in them. And I think that's a really, really good example. And parents have to be, I think mothers in particular, have to be really aware of comments that they make about their own bodies, because their daughters pick up on it very, very quickly.
What about, you know, Do you deal with any of the more serious concerns? Like, do you evaluate or treat adolescents who have more serious concerns around food, for example, like any kind of eating disorders?
Well, I do assess that, and if I am really concerned that a child is developing an eating disorder, I refer them on. There are programs in some of the hospitals in the area, North York General, South Lake, Lake Ridge hospitals, eating disorder programs that do a wonderful job of assessing. They really specialize in that, assessing for eating disorders, anorexia and bulimia, and provide group and individual programs for the adolescents.
Any simple signs that parents could be looking for if they, so that they know that maybe this is a good time to take my daughter or son to a professional?
If you see that your child is losing weight, if you see that they're not eating the way they had in the past, so a change in eating patterns, I would be concerned. Bulimia involves purging. Mm-hmm. And if a parent is really aware of their child, if they're having meals together and the child is excusing him or herself.
Can you just define purging?
Purging is getting rid of the food that you've eaten by various means. One is vomiting.
Right.
Or using laxatives.
Right.
Another way that wouldn't necessarily be called purging is increased exercise.
Right.
So again, if you see that your child's exercising a tremendous amount and they were a couch potato before,
right,
that's a red flag. What's going on?
Or if they have a meal and go directly to their bedroom to do jumping jacks.
Exactly. Or if they go to the bathroom.
Right.
You know, just... I would go towards the washroom and
listen.
I think that's really important.
Any other self-injurious behavior that you might treat or come up against, like adolescents who cut themselves, for
example? Yes, I have seen a number of adolescents who cut themselves. And cutting is often related to depression. So these are kids who are, their self-esteem is really low. Their mood is low. Cutting is often a way of coping with a low mood. It's not a good way of coping. It's quite a negative way of coping, but it helps the child to feel that they're alive and they seem to feel better after they've done it. What's really important is to help them to find more adaptive ways of coping. Right. Cutting is not an adaptive way. You also have to be aware, is this just a way of coping with a low mood, or is this a suicide attempt?
Right.
And so parents really, if they see that their child is cutting, they really should seek professional advice.
Right.
So that their child can be assessed. If they're depressed, the psychologist can recommend either therapy, recommend further medical evaluation in terms of perhaps medication. It depends on the situation, but cutting is serious and there does need to be follow-up.
And one of the things, and the other signs I find, is if kids are wearing always long-sleeved shirts.
Yes.
Even when it's hot outside, that's often their way of covering up the cutting. Because obviously,
yes,
some parents are very unaware that their children are cutting.
That's always a telltale sign.
Yeah.
And also, if they're wearing a lot of bracelets.
Yeah.
They're covering their arms,
yeah,
and their wrists. I think that's something to really... be observant. Parents must be observant. Also, cutting can be contagious. And what I mean by that is that children who are feeling depressed are often, they tend to gather together with other children who are depressed. And if one child is cutting, that often leads to another one cutting.
Yeah.
So this is not, you know, if a child... if their mood is normal, I wouldn't be worried about that contagion. However, if their mood is low, then that contagion effect can often take place.
And I guess, as you said, you know, hormones are changing during adolescence, so a mood can be impacted by hormonal change. And I guess there could be room there even for medical intervention in terms of doctors taking blood work, correct, to evaluate hormonal changes. I mean, is that detectable through blood work, I wonder?
That's not something I'm really aware of. I
maybe
don't
some
know.
Some specialists may be able to evaluate hormonal levels and see what impact, like physiologically, how much of it is related and how much of it might be related to what's going on in the family dynamic or something else that's happening at home, or as you said, just with children going through that normal angst through that period of adolescence, in terms of that whole push and pull between wanting to be dependent and wanting to be independent and fear of the future and change and all that kind of stuff. As you said, it's a very tumultuous time, and as parents we can feel like we're on this emotional roller coaster, but our teenagers do too. And so what I'm hearing you say, and I don't know if you'd agree with this, is that as much as we feel like we're having a hard time and we're like want to throw up our hands and say, you know, I've had enough, this teenager is driving me crazy, to be aware that our teenagers are probably going through, if not worse of a time, in dealing with the changes in their body too.
Definitely. It's a tough time for everybody, but there are also really positive moments with your teen, and it's really important to hang in there and not to personalize it when your teen says things to you that
maybe
hurtful. Exactly.
Right.
You know, it's a phase that they are going through.
Yeah.
Then again, you also don't want to sit there and be
abused.
Insulted and abused.
No, I often say to parents to try not to listen to the words, but to read between the lines. Don't, as you said, get caught up in the I hate yous or I'll never talk to you again or whatever. And not to say things back like, well, I love you anyway, which could create a, you know, negative response. But just to say, I can see you're really angry right now. We can talk about it later. So again, to just acknowledge what's going on between
the
lines.
That's
so,
right.
Yeah, I agree. I've seen many rough, I've seen many parents go through very rough periods with their teenagers and grow out of it, so that they have wonderful, healthy relationships. And I know that is absolutely doable. Anything else that you want to add?
I would just say that most teenagers, although, as you've just said, although the process can be a tumultuous, rough one, they do come out the other side as, you know, intelligent adults with good judgment and common sense. And parents shouldn't just throw up their hands and say, I can't do this. Just hang in there.
Yeah.
And
there's lots of books. I've got some listed on my website in terms of parenting and parenting teens. Any specials or favorites for you?
One of my favorites is by Anthony Wolfe.
Oh, yes.
And I think it's called Get Out of My Life, But First Will You Take Cheryl and Me to the Mall?
Yeah, I've seen that one too.
It's really a wonderful book.
Parents can relate to it.
Yes.
Especially that title.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Karen. And thank you for listening to this podcast. We hope you found it informative. For more information about us and to learn more about other free seminars that I'm hosting, visit helpmesara.com. Please subscribe and rate us on iTunes by searching for Help Me Sara. And Sara is spelled S-A-R-A, no H. You can send your questions, comments, and suggestions for future podcasts by emailing me at podcast@helpmesara.com, by tweeting me at helpmesara, or by calling me at 905-882-7690. Until next time.